You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It's the 22nd of February 2023, and this is yet another episode of the Orthodox Nationalist, a weekly lecture series concerning all things connected to the Russian and Greek Orthodox churches and cognate fields. It's also connected to the website, The Orthodox Medievalist, and I've actually gone back and forth, in that case, the Russian Orthodox Medievalist, and I've gone back and forth between those two terms, ethno-nationalism on the one hand and the medieval world on the other. Those two areas don't deal with the same sort of thing. They're at the two different levels of abstraction. But I've held the view that they have much more in common than is normally normally given credit for. One of the stupidest things that a human being can say is that nationalism came from the French Revolution. It's stupid. And it's just gruelingly ignorant because it was a negation of all cultural ties among people. The Declaration of the Rights of Man has nothing to do with being French or the French tradition. When you talk about the tradition of European ethnicities, you're automatically going back to the Middle Ages as one of the zenith of European life in so many different ways, both sides of the European divide. But the Middle Ages, you know, often we refer to terms like feudalism and chivalry. And we're only really talking about a few areas in France, Germany, and maybe under the hands of an empire in parts of Britain. Those terms tend to only be associated with those areas, despite the fact that they're used universally. It's one of the many errors of liberals and Marxists is that they use terms like feudal or absolute in very equivocally. In Eastern Europe, as well as in the West, in places like Ireland, but also places like Russia, Ruthenia, Poland, certainly, Scandinavian countries, the Greeks, certainly the Italians, were very cognizant, Turks most certainly, very cognizant of their ethnicity. Even in empires that are allegedly multicultural, first of all, they were all Christians. They were all part of one family. But their ethnic groups functioned separately. Even in the military, they functioned separately. So ethnicity may not have been as politicized as it became later on. But crediting this to the French Revolution really is just more sloganeering for its own sake. It relieves somebody of the necessity of thinking. The French Revolution laid the groundwork for the destruction of nationhood, which is why the Romantic movement developed not too long after that as a reaction to the basic idea behind the Declaration of the Rights of Man. I think normally what they mean is that it was the foundation of a state that was not necessarily based on different estates, meaning, you know, peasantry, clergy, nobles, royals. Now, both of those are, depending on the circumstances, are congruent with nationalism and medievalism. And again, because they're talking about two very different things, it doesn't impact a nation could be built on many things, but certainly language, religion, and a common struggle, especially in the past. These are essential. These are absolutely crucial. Sometimes, because the word state, that is to say government, has altered its meaning so badly. In most of Europe, state refers to the ethnicity, the community. That's what the word constitution. The constitution was almost like a map of a nation's tradition. But state, we use the word state to refer to the formal institutions of rule. You know, police forces and the FDA and the executive branch, whatever we're talking about. But that's not normally what that term means. And this is very rarely discussed. But in people like Hegel, it's and Herder, it's extremely important. We see this also, not just in Europe, but within the Third World. You see the word state being used in two very different ways. So, ethnicity is always politicized to some degree, but the juxtaposition of a specific independent state based on a sense of belonging coming from ethnicity, it has always existed to a greater or lesser degree. Remember, elites in any society, however it's organized, want to maximize profits. We're talking about an oligarchy. They also want to separate themselves from the hoi polloi. So they're always a subversive force. Now, and they can pull away from any sense of community. To have the severe form of serfdom like you had in Poland, you had to tell a story that the elite in Poland, the oligarchs in Poland prior to the 18th century, the end of the 18th century, were of a different race than the peasantry. It's much easier when they were ruling over parts of Ukraine, for example. What we're going to talk about today is very closely connected to this. And we're talking about, you could refer to it two ways. The Serbian despotate, or the despots of Serbia, or the age of Serbian chivalry. And this, it's significant because it's a very obscure area. However important, it generally runs, this era runs generally from 1402, not too long after the Kosovo battle, to 1459. Of course, in 1459, all of the Serbian lands and most of the Balkans were brought directly under Turkish control. Clearly, ethnicity the Serbian ethnicity, Bulgarian ethnicity, and their battles against the Greeks in a lot of different ways, especially under the Turks, and the Turks themselves, reached a high level of development. The revolution against that kind of imperialism, wherever you go, has to be based on national belonging, however that ends up being organized. And even the communists had to make appeals to it, however dishonestly. They did, but it's, you know, Marxism and anarchism are purely negative. It's nothing but a critique of the present circumstance. When it comes to how to organize society, it's a very different story. They don't have much to say. The fact that communist states have been organized pretty much the same way, using collectivization and forced industrialization, atheism, all the rest, that gives us a clue. But none of these movements start and start telling people this. This is what we're going to do. They never do. They always claim that they're going to give land to the peasantry, despite the fact that they don't believe in private property. So we're talking about one of the key periods of Serbian Balkan history. This is extremely important for the mentality of orthodoxy. We're talking about Serbia specifically. And the development of the Serbian and the Montenegrin national ideology. We're also talking about something some of you may know, and that's the Order of the Dragon, which was a multinational association founded to make war on Turkey. And you'll see that this is not quite as simple as it seems to be the way I'm describing it. Serbia was one of the wealthiest states outside of Byzantium itself because it sits on the water. It has access to the important port cities, you know, Alessio and Budva and Bay of Kotor, Dracula, and all the way down almost to the island of Corfu. That access and the fact that Serbia is blessed with a lot of natural resources allowed these despots, and that's their formal title coming from Byzantium, to not just revive Serbian statehood, however briefly, but actually be very prosperous. I'm very interested in the idea of these, I like to call them emergency states. We talked about it with when Constantinople was taken by the Crusaders, how they created their own mini Byzantiums elsewhere and eventually took over Epirus and Nicaea. Now, that's what's happening here. Turkey had completely surrounded Constantinople. We're in an era only of the last two emperors. I've done a whole show on the fall of Byzantium, especially after the fall of Byzantium, in 1453. You notice that the years I just mentioned include, you know, Turkey finally won not just Constantinople, but secured the Balkans only in 1459, 1460. Their ethnicity and religion were so, I mean, you know, the Turks are not that far racially from Europeans. They're not necessarily a dark-skinned people or anything like that, but they understand themselves as Asian. And because of that, they were foreigners. This is no different than Athens and Persia. The Order of the Dragon was a last-ditch effort to save the Balkans from the Turks. They were growing very quickly. They had a huge Jewish fifth column. And because, and you see the prosperity of the despotates, or the despotate itself, there is one group of people who is noticeably absent from their ruling circles. These states, or I should really, the despotate, essentially one state with changing boundaries, itself was a last-ditch effort to save Serbian nationalism and orthodoxy from the Turks. It didn't last long. They tried to create many Serbias in different parts of the Balkans, basically, you know, sort of congruent with a piece of the old Serbian empire of Dušan. So, and I've said before, I talked about the fall of Constantinople, that it was almost unbelievable for people to wrap their heads around that the queen of cities, the city of cities, Rome itself, because Western Rome wasn't particularly relevant. If it wasn't for the papacy, it would have no purpose at all. It had been sacked so many times. Constantinople was the wealthiest city in the world. And for a long time, one of the most stable. It was almost impossible to consider that there's going to be a world without it. But as it stands, the beginning of the 15th century, Constantinople has lost a huge portion of its territory and its population. I said a few weeks ago in the Constantinople lecture that it was down to 50,000 people at most within the city walls. And that was happening throughout the Balkans. But it does get complicated. So these emergency states, this is what happens when you lose your statehood and you need to go elsewhere to reconstitute it. Now, in this case, going elsewhere is still Serbia, but only a piece of it, and only really the northern piece of it. The Turks, we all know what happened. Contrary to the mythology of this tolerant Islam, if you didn't convert, you were a third-class citizen. So, and this is the first time that knighthood in the sense that Westerners use the concept of chivalry, was ever a part of an Orthodox nation. So we know what happened in 1389 in the Battle of Kosovo. This is the Serbian reaction to the Battle of Kosovo. The childhood of Stefan Lazarevic ended when his father, the great martyr Prince Lazar, was killed in the Battle of Kosovo. And as a young man, he inherited the Serbian throne. He had four sisters, and one of them, Mara, was married to Vuk Branković, who's going to be very relevant here. He will soon die in Turkish captivity. And one of his three sons, Draj, or George, took over and became, in fact, the despot himself. So after Kosovo, the Lazarevic and Branković families were the two most influential families in Serbia and were vassals of at least a faction of the Turkish Empire. We're going to get to that in a minute because it sounds very strange to say. Keep in mind that despot, again, it's one of these words that has lost its original meaning and now, in fact, means something almost entirely opposite what it initially was. A despot is a court title from Byzantium granted to relatively minor rulers, vassals, so to speak, of Constantinople. It was the Emperor Emmanuel, who we've mentioned, you know, near the end of Byzantium, who gave these guys that title. Therefore, they had the right to rule based on that. They were confirmed, so to speak, by the emperor as the Byzantine Empire was falling to pieces. So at the time, very beginning of the 15th century, Bayezid was the sultan in Turkey who was dedicated to conquering Europe. This is before the fall of Constantinople, of course. But God works in very strange ways, especially when it comes to international politics, because this is the era of Tamerlane. You know my opinion on the Mongols. He was not a Mongol, not in the sense that they are Asiatic. Contemporary artwork, as well as reconstructions since then, show him as white as anybody else. But he is considered one of the most brilliant military tacticians in the world and created a huge empire in Central Asia. And Turkey and Tamerlane, faced each other. And this is in 1402 in Angora. This is one of the reasons that the despotate has its origin in 1402. Now the Serbian prince Stefan Lazarevic was working for Bayezid, and he had a force under George Branković as well. Stefan clearly, well, of course, he was very young at the time, was inexperienced, and you had many Serbs fighting on the same side as the Turks against the Mongols. The so-called Mongols, you know, they may have had Asiatic units, but Tamerlane, as well as the so-called Mongol emperors in the past, all are depicted as white. Only much, much later were they depicted as Asiatic. And we've talked about that in the past. Well, as you probably know, the Turks were destroyed. And that was a shock in and of itself. So the King of Hungary, and Hungary is very relevant in Serbian history, for better or for worse, King Sigismund gathered a large army and the papacy launched another crusade. And because the Serbs were vassals of Turkey, despite having a Byzantine title, the Serbs were forced to do battle with with Hungary. And, of course, this was a crusader army. It had French cavalry that were well-equipped, far more numerous, and they were very reckless. The Turkish lines did eventually buckle here. I mean, it was probably the best cavalry in Europe at the time. Bayezid sent troops from Anatolia, and the crusaders struggled. The Serbian mounted forces led by Stefan entered the battle, and the crusaders were defeated. And Sigismund's army very quickly began to disintegrate and fled. From there, they went home and told about who these Serbs are. Strictly Orthodox, of course. The fact that they were connected with one faction of the Turkish ruling class wasn't really held against them, since there was no choice in the matter. We'll see here that siding with one faction or another of the Turkish royal family and military was important as a way to keep them under control. So, while Turkey was annihilated against Tamerlane, they emerged victorious along with the Serbs against the Hungarian-led French crusade. And in Angora, all of both the Byzantine and the Persian chroniclers spoke of the very brave and powerful and disciplined Serbian forces. And ultimately, in the battle of, as I mentioned, the battle in 1402, Bayezid, who refused to retreat, was taken captive and was killed. There are Persian chronicles said that among the Turkish prisoners there were many Serbs. We're talking still about Tamerlane here, not the Hungarians. Tamerlane ordered that everyone be cut down except the Serbs, because he said he had never seen heroism like that in his life. One of the reasons that the Serbs were making deals with the Turks was they really was no one else. But once Bayezid died, you had faction struggles within the Turkish Empire. So many of their best men were killed. And and that was the only reason that the Turkish forces were able to survive at all. And with that experience, then made war on the Crusaders. We all know, unfortunately, the Crusaders, no matter how necessary it may have been at the time, the Crusaders were going to force Catholicism, not just on the Orthodox, but on everyone else that they came in contact with. So, afterwards, Stefan was welcomed back in Constantinople as a famous knight, and that's where he got the title of despot. And for Turkey, it was an extremely rough period of time, because there was no obvious successor, and the Turkish army had been humiliated, not just humiliated by defeat, but by the fact that it survived at all only because of Serbia. That's when the Hungarian king actually made an ally out of Stefan, especially since he, despite, you know, not being Orthodox, a Byzantine court title like that was extremely important and very impressive. So there was a moment where Serbia could breathe a sigh of relief. And in Constantinople, Stefan, the now despot of Serbia, after leaving Constantinople on an Italian ship, took his position. And he was supposed to marry Yelena, who was a daughter of the king of Lesbos in Greece. And she had, you know, she had her own purpose in this family. And her Stefan's older sister, was married to the Lord of Zeta, or, you know, mostly Montenegro coastal areas, George Belsic, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. So the defeat of the Turks against Tamerlane split the Serbian ruling class into both, as I've mentioned, the Brankovic and Lazarevic clans. George, the leader of the Brankovic family, wanted to use Stephen's new alliance with the Hungarians to actually take the Serbian throne with the help of the Turks. Now, Stefan's had his supporters in Constantinople who arranged for Duraj, or George, to be held, you know, arrested, so to speak, until the Lazarevic could consolidate power in Serbia itself, but that failed. Now, this tends to get very complicated. If you look at a map of this era and the next 100 years, it's a patchwork of states and governments. With, as far as the Balkans go, you have this huge Ottoman Empire, and just to the north, the despotate in Serbia, Novo Brdo, Prizren, and Pesh, and then just to the west of that, places like Budva in the Bay of Kotor, and these republican systems that existed there, based entirely on trade. It's extremely complicated. So Stefan's, who was a son-in-law of Gerard Balsic, made his way to his court, actually in Krusevac, via Kosovo. And as he entered into the town of Tripolia, almost like a Tripoli, the Brankovic faction was waiting for them with Turkish forces. And in the same place where Serbia then, you know, lost its freedom at this point 13 years earlier, Stefan, his father, now had to fight against his own relatives, the Brankovic and the Turks. And Duraj was his opponent in this case. And it seems, although this is kind of controversial, the Battle of Tripolia ended really without an obvious victor. Stefan did defeat the Turkish forces and drove them out of the area. But on his way back, he found a handful of men that he had left. But even that, I mean, some say even 20 horsemen with their retainers, because of the damage done to the Brankovic, he was able to use a handful to consolidate power in this new state. Now in Turkey, the sons of Bayezid, he had four sons. One of the reasons that they really didn't have a problem making deals with the Turks is that at this point, Stefan was often the decisive factor in Turkish politics, at least at the upper levels. The fact that he was an ally of the Hungarian king gave him a great degree, not just security to the north, but respect and assistance. And in 1408, he moved the capital to Belgrade, which he restored. And these were fairly, we'll get to the reason why these states were so wealthy here in a minute, but they were. And it was in 1408 that he became a knight in the Order of the Dragon. The Brankovici had very little. Alternative Serbian family. So even in the face of colonialism and defeat by the Turks, they're fighting each other. They had very few possessions, and their only real option was to become an even better ally of Turkey. And they took part in most of the Turkish battles at the time. And they went from city to city, battle to battle, sometimes being a good ally, sometimes not being. It was a very risky strategy. George's or Drive's younger brother, Lazar, was killed in these conflicts. And the elder brother, Grigori, was fed up with this kind of life, and he went to Hollander and became a monk. And Draj, or George, was preserved, as strange as it may seem. Because if anyone should have been killed here, it was probably him. By the end of 1411, George was in the camp of the faction that he sided with, and that's Bayezid's son, Musa. And they were at war with Greeks, some small cities that they were putting under siege. Now, the old Turkish leader had four sons. Two were already dead. And really, Stefan and Duraj were the only adult male members of their families still alive. Musa was called the Megatherian, the great or furious beast. And it was important for this is important for Turkish history, because Musa has already beheaded dozens of pashas, bey, or the rulers and landlords, and even Christian rulers, Christian nobles. And he tried to poison George because he was a Serb. And the poison apparently didn't work. He got very sick, but he was aware of their penchant for poisoning and had a doctor with him that had the antidote. So Brankovic found out about, you know, of course, this is clearly from the Turks. And he was eventually taken in by the Greek that he just fought against on the grounds that, you know, this is a Christian battle. And they were allowed into the besieged city where they were at the time. And Musa had to watch this. And he spent the winter in Silimivra. And he had about 150 knights left. He went on a Venetian ship and went to Thessaly, escaping Turkish ambushes, really ending up with only five mounted warriors. And in 1412, he ended up in Serbia itself. So that's your, you know, introduction, so to speak. The despotate was a strong monarchy, a militarized, highly monastic monarchy, in part of the old lands of Serbia from 1402 to 1459. Of course, the point was to ideologically continue the traditions of the old Serbian Empire of Nemanja. They rebuilt the institutions and the constitutions of the medieval Serbian Empire, which, thanks to mining and their access to the sea, was very well off. The despotate was militarized, and therefore the concept of the soldier, especially the mounted soldier, being a monk, I mean, that kind of was old news in the West, but for Orthodoxy it was a very different story. The church itself, especially through its monasteries, was militarized. There is no concept of any kind of pacifism anywhere, for very obvious reasons. No one could afford it. And it just makes my blood boil when you see how the successors of these people now have, in Serbia, post-Yugoslavia, have given in to European demands. Yeah, they may be able to survive Tamerlane. Liberalism is a different story, though. So, St. Lazar had St. Lazar, the famous Kosovo, Stefan, also canonized, what we're talking about, earned his spurs, so to speak, in these Turkish campaigns. I mean, most of the time, they were fighting rebellious emirs. And Turkey was able to expand its system of vassals. And then they eventually became Ottoman provinces. And of course, Bulgaria was soon to fall. Bosnia was soon to fall. Wallachia. And Bayezid actually had defeated the Duke of Mircea, the Battle of Ravine in 1394. And even as far as, you know, pushing King Sigismund in Hungary to take some measures against the Turkish invasion, there was no stopping Turkey, with the exception of that one huge war with Tamerlane. But that crusade, as I mentioned, was earlier than that. It was 1396. So Hungary had gone back and forth in their view. It ultimately became pro-Serbian throughout the Turkokratia, the rule of the Turks, because in Ukraina, or the military district just in the very south of the empire, you know, bordering Vojvodina in northern Serbia. So the Turks were only stopped by Tamerlane, but because they already had duties to factions of Turkey, and this was only for strategic reasons. Remember, there's a lot of players there, some stronger than others. Of course, the conditions of their fealty with Turkey was to keep their religion and customs separate. And it's sort of like, you know, Moscow making common cause with the so-called Mongols, the invaders from the steppe. But Turkey was shocked by the by what happened in Angora, and that's extremely important. So then we have this array of power relations. I mentioned Bayezid died 1403, and just like everywhere else, his four sons, there was a battle. And this is one of the reasons that Serbia had no problem working for them, because they were weak and divided. So there was a war between Isa and Mehmed, and then Mehmed and Suleiman. And ultimately, he made a deal with Byzantium to stay in power. Venice, Genoa, Naxos. And because of this, the Byzantines were able to regain Thessalonica and even Mount Athos. But Stefan still kept the position he had with the Turks. Now, I should note that even after the battle in Kosovo, the Hungarians didn't come in as helpers. Obviously, they fought the crusading war. But he also tried to take advantage of Serbian weakness at the time. It was called the Nicopolis Crusade. Part of the problem, too, is that part of this deal was meant that the princesses, Melitia and Galina, were hostages at the port. This is part of you know, how things were done. In fact, she had a certain influence over the Sultan and did not retaliate for some of the rebellious Serbs. And St. Stefan Lazarevich also visited the port in Turkey. Beginning of the 15th century, Hungary was in the midst of a civil war. You had Ladislaus of Naples, who was from the Angevin dynasty, was backed by Pope Benedict, Boniface IX. Sigismund himself spent some time in captivity, and only in 1403 did he enter Buda. But Ladislaus' most powerful ally were the Vukic family in Serbia, Vucic, but he needed allies. Sigismund certainly needed allies to fight Ladislaus. And therefore, he had to make nice with the Serbs. And Stefan, being a very smart man, accepted it. And now the Serbs were, at least in now that Lazar has, Stefan Lazarevich has consolidated power, there was a reconciliation with Hungary, but a very indirect kind of vassal relationship. Remember, vassalage, especially in this era, was largely a symbolic relationship. Of course, you know, locally, they were completely independent. And the battles between Hungary and Serbia were solved in this case. Their territorial disputes, even from the death of King, the great Tsar Dragutin, going back 100 years. The Serbs have been trying to recapture Belgrade for this period of time. And Nikola St. Stefan had built this new capital in Serbia, in Belgrade. He also succeeded, partially because of his former support of the Turks, received several cities, Golubac on the Danube. And in 1406, Stefan's deputies announced in Venice — Venice was an extremely wealthy and very powerful player here, and in my books on the topic, I'm not very nice to them, because it was oligarchy, and the marriage of the sea and all the occult nonsense that I've spoken about was more important to them than anything else — but announced that the despotate was no longer a vassal of the Turks and was ready to do battle. Stefan even wrote a new charter to Hollandar, 1405. And Sigismund then took credit for this, and the Hungarians were strengthened because they brought the Serbs away from Turkey and indirectly made them an ally of that. Now, I've already suggested the end of 1403, you had bad blood within the Serbian ruling class. They talked about Stefan launching an attack on the Brankovici in early 1404. However, he was still able to expel Turkish beys throughout the country. And any uprising against him, he very quickly, egged on by the Muslims, was able to put down quickly. Even to the point now, especially with the Hungarian alliance, he reconciled with Brankovic in 1404. The Hungarians in this same time were involved in assisting the Bulgarians in their uprising against Turkey. Not only did they have Serbian support, they also had a Greek support, and they certainly had Hungarian support. And with his victories, and with the wealth, you know, he had a charter with the Republic of Dubrovnik, very wealthy, and the littoral on Zita, or that western part of Serbia on the water. However, and this is the problem, as Lazarevic Stefan became wealthier, largely through mining and trade on the littoral, Venice was very upset. Now there's a Hungarian, Serbian, Greek alliance, and the Venetians sought to stop this. Venice revoked many of their treaties with the Serbs, and in the Skadar region on the water, the Venetians had taken over certain Serbian areas. And the uprising against that was led by a man, Balša III, who quickly occupied these Venetian cities. It's called the Skadar War from 1405 to 1412. Later, they restored their rule. And once Balša, as we've mentioned already, found himself in trouble. Remember, the Venetians had money. They're able to hire mercenaries. He had to go to Suleiman for help. He had to go to the Turks again. Venice wins because they had cash in hand. And in 1408, a peace agreement was finally reached. One of the key elements here is the city of Kotor, the Bay of Kotor. Extremely wealthy trading city to the north, relative to Serbia itself. And Venice made a deal with them rather than the Serbs. Venice had far more in common with them anyway. And in fact, they were willing to pay tribute to Suleiman for for the cities that they had taken in Zeta and northern Albania. They even bought the rights to Dalmatia from Ladislav of Naples. And I know it's complicated and it's disjointed, but that's the nature of the circumstances. And it's also why the despotate was so immensely important. Remember, Stefan and Sigismund were still allies. And as a result of all of this, with the goading of Venice, the Turks tried to retake Belgrade. And he refused, as Stefan returned to Belgrade, refused to surrender, and needed to make sure that he and his brother were on very good terms. Vuk, his brother, got the southern part of the country, and together with the Brankovich family, although defeated, they were still willing to see themselves as indirect vassals of Suleiman. Why? Because Stefan sided with Suleiman's brother Musa, as I mentioned already. He won over both Wallachian ruling class as well as the Bulgarian insurgents. It's one Turkish faction used against another. Suleiman and Musa were fighting each other. So yes, the Christians were fighting each other, so were the Turks. In fact, the Byzantine Emperor Manuel backed Suleiman. He was supported by Vuk Lazarevic, the Venetians, the Brankovici. And on the Golden Horn, 1410, Musa was defeated. And Stefan again took refuge in Constantinople, where Manuel had received him. Now, Musa took power in the European part of Turkey. His tolerance didn't last long. He began to turn his friends into enemies, and even Stefan's envoys were threatened in Constantinople. There's no relationship with Turkey, I don't care what faction it is, that's going to last long in this period of time. The whole point of the despotate is to keep the Turks at bay, but also the Hungarians and Venetians. These are small, tightly centralized states surrounded by enemies. It gets very complicated when you consider that the Brankovich was in Musa's army. And even the Byzantine emperor, though, said, you know, you've done too much. Then they went to Mehmet, yet another brother, hoping that the Turks will end up fighting each other. The Serbs only entered the fight again in 1411, and Musa actually in 1412 penetrated right into the despotate itself and ravaged parts of the farmland, even Novo Brdo, but ultimately had to retreat. He was overextended. But because of all this complexity and difficulty, the ethnicity of Serbia under the Great Stepan Lazarevic was extremely well consolidated. It was consolidated politically within the monarchy, consolidated religiously, where monasticism saw a new flowering, the calm before the storm, so to speak, the silver and gold mines throughout Serbian territory, and their access to the water, regardless of what was going on with Venice, made this mini-empire a huge success. And I don't even want to use the word empire because it was an ethnically Serbian movement. As I've already mentioned, there's one group of people who are not to be found within Belgrade. However, they were working with the Turks. I'm not talking about the Hindu. So Stefan even took Srebrenica, which we've spoken of before, very famous in the wars of the late 20th century, also a huge silver mining town. And even negotiations between Durad Brankovic and Stefan ended very, very well. But Musa wasn't finished. Because of the firm, and this is strictly an ethnic monarchy, an ethnarchy, so to speak, the war against Turkey never stopped. Against, in this particular case, Musa. I think you could probably tell that they used each other whenever it was necessary, because none of them, especially after Tamerlane, years earlier, no faction was strong enough really to function on their own. Hungary had probably the best chance of this. The Patriarchate had moved and is now part of Stefan's society. The resistance, once the despotate was founded and consolidated, preparations for war were done, largely by the church, especially the monastic establishment. With Hungarian assistance, again, these ever-shifting alliances defeated Musa, however temporarily. Byzantium, for their part, sided with yet another brother, Mehmed, and even provided him with assistance in bringing troops to Europe. The Byzantines were not innocent as far as Turkish advancing into Europe is concerned. In fact, they helped to finance it, so long as that family remained divided and fighting one another. But Musa, once he took some kind of power, installed a highly militant Islamic movement, which alienated even his strongest allies. And the decisive battle took place in July of 1413. Musa was finally defeated. He was killed when he was fleeing Sultan Mehmed I, who died himself in 1421. And the war ended. So from Mehmed, as a reward for helping to destroy Musa, there was a treaty that gave him extra territory. Zenopele, which is right near the Serbian-Bulgarian border. He had no problem having these multiple vassal obligations. And because of the wealth, the power of Serbia, regardless of who their allies were at the time, Venice was very wary about continuing any kind of war against them. And in fact, they opened negotiations between the Serbs in Bosnia and the Bay of Kotor itself. And it just so happens that the Hungarians were also opposed to the expansion of Venice on the Adriatic coast. Clearly, the mining and the access to port cities were extremely important. So the state of Stefan Lazarevich, this despotate, was rich in minerals. Mining was key to the old Serbian Empire, as well as to what we're talking about here. Economic policy was centralized and based around both trade and mining, which they attempted to maximize. Charter on mines, assisted labor, and in terms of the administration of this, it was very modern in the sense of the modern state. He issued new laws, Nova Brdo in 1412, for example. That was the largest Serbian, in fact, the largest Balkan silver mine, and not just normal silver, but fine silver or pure silver as well, highly advanced in this sense. Then Sablanta, of course, is extremely important. About 7 or 8 tons of silver mined per year, which, of course, at the time is a big deal. They also produce wax, and that actually was part of, they went to the Italian cities. The wealth from these mines were used to pay off the Sultan. I mentioned someone else, Balša III. Good news for Serbia is that Venice and Hungary were now fighting each other. Sometimes it's called the Second Skadar War in 1419. Balša, of course, is a member of the Serbian royal family, arrested all Venetians on the coast in Zeta. And Venice, never having a lot of people, but having a very advanced diplomacy and a lot of money, and then Venice, not surprisingly, went to the Turks as allies in 1419. And Venetians would pay tribute to the Turks if they assist them in taking these coastal areas, which were so wealthy and very important. They hired them as mercenaries against Balša. So he could not campaign against Venetian cities anymore. And the Bay of Kotor, the oligarchy there, placed itself under the rule of Venice. And this is, you know, this is extremely important financially speaking. Balsa was, this gets very complicated. It's from the house of Balsic, the son of Durad and Yelena, and took over, and it was very important to him to take over Zita because of its potential wealth. And it didn't take long for Zita to be annexed to, the Serbian state. And finally, in 1421, roughly, the areas under Lazarevic, Brankovic, and Balsik were unified. And all lands that had Serbs living in them were under one ruler. Once Balsa, and Balsa was very useful to the Serb, being a Serb himself, very useful. Once he died, Venice began to reconquer these cities again, using Turks, using other mercenaries. All of Balsa's charters were annulled. This was not an oligarchic rule. This was an aristocratic rule. However, they wouldn't persecute any of the Serbian side for any of the wars. This is part of the Venetian the treaty. And even the city of Bar submitted to Venice. So, despite the fact that Serbia had this brand new unity, they did have a very powerful opponent. But Stefan ended up taking the city ruled by Balsa in the far west, and created a truce, in fact. And part of the reason is that even though Venice had taken some of these wealthy cities, you had Slavs rebelling against them. As I mentioned before, the reaction to Serbian strength from Venice created their own direct alliance with the Turks. But because they tried to repress the Orthodox Church, Serbian language, etc., you had rebellions against the Venetian administration. And Venice was forced to make concessions. And one of them was that Stefan had taken the wealthy port city of Bar. And while war flared up now and again, the Serbs were busy building fortifications on their river system inland, where the mines are, to reach the coast. Unfortunately, again, for the despotate, Sigismund and Hungary and Turkey signed a 5-year peace treaty. This is now the reign of Mehmet, the Sultan, but it didn't matter because Stefan still had good relations with Turkey. They had to balance one another, and they did a very good job of it under extreme circumstances. And as Lazarevic continued to consolidate power, in fact, some of the largest fortresses in Serbia were built under his reign. Belgrade became an armed camp. At the same time, again, this is all before the fall of Constantinople, Byzantium supported a self-proclaimed Turkish emperor, Mustafa, who also sent emissaries to Stefan, but he wouldn't have any of it. He was killed in 1422. A younger brother with the same name rose up against Mehmet. Byzantium supported him. Murad eventually besieged Constantinople in 1422, as I've mentioned in the past. And of course, it withstood the siege like it had many times before. He was killed in Asia Minor. As this is happening, you know, Byzantium is doing everything it can to foment division within Turkey. But as this is happening, Serbia is remaining largely on, you know, to the side. In fact, Murat was given, the Turk was given the title of despot, and also on good terms with the Hungarian king Sigismund. So, while complicated, this is absolutely, you know, this is the key to understanding the development of Serbian ethnicity once the empire fell. But this ethnic development, whether it be under Stefan or his brother Duraz, who once Stefan died, was proclaimed king of the Serbs or despot, I should say. They both had that title anyway. And he became the ruler of the Serbs, but also engaged in the very same diplomatic maneuvering as his brother. He lost Belgrade and had to surrender it. Duraz was left without a capital, and Smederevo was a new city built by him. In order to get away with this, he had to offer a daughter to the imperial harem. And just like his brother, Duraz was fortifying the area as much as humanly possible. Smederevo was almost a mini Byzantium. It was a small town, but with extremely powerful fortress walls. And he spared no expense in building a version of the Byzantine court. They had 24 towers in this small town. This is the brand new capital. And of course, it was designed to withstand the inevitable. In fact, the Greeks oversaw this fortress building, which was extremely significant. And I say the inevitable because ultimately this is all going to come to an end. In the meantime, though, Venice and Turkey were at war over the ports or the city of Thessaloniki, and it fell into Turkish hands in 1430. An uprising in Albania, 1433, which had strong Serbian support. Even Bosnia then eventually fell. But even sending his daughter to the harem, second daughter, 1435, it didn't save him. Everything that these guys were doing were simply postponing what we now know was inevitability. Serbia had too many enemies, and despite its wealth and tremendous consolidation of ethnicity, it couldn't hold out against the massive rebuilt Turkish empire, especially once Constantinople fell. Especially once Mehmed II took over in 1451. Of course, he's the conqueror of Constantinople. He pursued a very peaceful policy towards the West in order to get them off his back. In fact, even had a vassal relationship with Serbian rulers. The Hungarian-Turkish peace was a huge problem for the Serbs. And in fact, you even had a handful of Serbs that took part in the siege of Constantinople in 1453. Duraz took the fall of Constantinople very, very hard. He locked himself in a room for 3 days. He didn't see anybody, but was forced to remain a vassal of the Sultan. Duraz was able to ransom many captured Greeks. A lot of the church books and relics were brought north. And right after the fall of Constantinople, Mehmed sought to conquer the rest of the Balkans to the north. Duraz eventually takes refuge in Hungary, and the Turks took Smederevo. And they were given all these promises about how they were going to be ruled, and of course it never happened. Some of them opened the gates to the Turks, and Mehmed enslaved them. Hunyadi in Hungary was preparing to attack the Turks. You still have this crusading spirit that existed there. The Turks were thrown back for a short time, but eventually even Hunyadi in Hungary was defeated in the fall of 1454. And it all came crashing down. The point of all of this, of course, is to give a strong example of the consolidation of ethnicity and monarchy. This is why the Serbian Empire lived on in memory, because it was mobilized and radically nationalized until Smederevo fell in June of 1459. And that marks the rule, the actually the start of direct Ottoman rule over all of Serbia. And it lasted right up until 1804. And it's difficult to judge anybody. But many of these smaller cities were able to open up their gates to the Turks, because Mehmet promised them, the sky, and none of it was taken seriously. His word didn't mean anything. So between 1453 and 1459, this was the twilight of Orthodox statehood in the Balkans. These are emergency states. They were going to hold out as long as they possibly could. They're going to make all kinds of shifting alliances, whether it be Hungary or Turkey. They were going to be, Venice, unfortunately, was nothing but a problem. Venice is one of the reasons that this whole thing fell. And they had already made deals with the Turks, no matter who they were fighting at the time. And the dark night of the Turkocratia and the destruction of the church and the takeover of Constantinople through the Fanar was begun. But the attack by Tamerlane gave both the Serbs and the Greeks a much longer lease on life. No one was able to follow up on that defeat. And so it was at the fringes of Tamerlane's empire, but they were able to rebuild themselves. I had a lot more to go over, but I had to really summarize it very quickly at the end. This is the consolidation of ethnicity. It is not the French Revolution that created nationalism. This is sort of the thing that created nationalism, this suffering, especially in the face of foreign colonial power. Suffering creates strong people, especially strong men. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.